Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Lance Herndon was at the top of his game in 1996. At age 41, he was a self-made millionaire, the owner of Access Incorporated, a successful information systems consulting company. As a prominent member of Atlanta's young, wealthy, and powerful set, he was surrounded by Black Atlanta's beautiful people. But when he failed to show up for work one day, friends and family started to worry. Their worry soon turned to horror when he was found murdered in his own home, his head smashed in what appeared to be either an act of jealousy-fueled rage or a seedier sex crime. With a laundry list of ex-wives and lovers, competitors, critics, and admirers in hand, detectives had to break through the city's upper crust to discover his killer. Journalist Ron Stodgill tells the riveting true story of this investigation. Part investigative thriller, part sociological commentary, Redbone offers a truly intriguing story that channels insight into one of America's great metropolises. The book that we're featuring this evening is Redbone, The Millionaire and the Gold Digger, with my special guest, journalist and author, Ron Stodgill. Welcome to the program and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Ron Stodgill.
Hey, Dan, how are you? Thank you for having me, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Very, very interesting story, and we get to see another slice of Americana with this incredible story. Tell us, without giving any of this story away, because I have lots of questions for you, tell us how you came to be in a position that you would write this book, Redbone.
Wow, I wish I had like a real sexy, you know, answer for that, but I'll tell you. I came about it, you know, this was like pre 9/11, and I was a writer at Time Magazine in New York, and I was talking to my dad one morning actually, and he had been watching court TV, you know, he's retired, and he was sort of distracted as we talked, and I said, "Dad, what's the deal? Like, you know, like, talk to me." And he was like, "Well, I'm sorry. There's just these gore. I'm watching court TV, and there are these hot, hot, beautiful women taking the stand one after another, and they're testifying about the murder of this guy who was this entrepreneur in Atlanta, you know, and it was sort of like Atlanta that really rang the bell for me, mostly because, you know, as an African American, having grown up in Detroit, a big major city, I'd watched so many people, like there was this reverse migration of people who had left, you know, moved north to work in the factories. That would be my family. My granddad, you know, worked in like the Cadillac plant, the Fisher Body plant is what it was called. And, right. You know, but they were like decades later, you know, those opportunities had sort of dried up and they were moving south again, you know, and this was their sort of progeny, their children, you know, that we were all moving. And so there was this sort of U-turn that had happened. And I love just narrative journalism. I love journalism about place. And I always thought Atlanta would be a great backdrop, but I just never, it would be a history lesson. I just wanted to tell the story of Atlanta, you know, and you know, it's very influenced by Capote, you know, and In Cold Blood and what he, you know, did in the heartland, you know, with that book and that murder. And then another one, more modern, which was the John Berendt book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which was, you know, another
right.
book, but it was sort of Savannah played, like it was its own character. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, so when I looked and I saw, you know, did a little research on Lance, I thought, wow, okay, this dude's a real player. You know, he ran around with the mayor at the time, and he had been cited by the Bush administration for his entrepreneurship and the Clinton administration. And I thought, let me just go poke around. I had just finished a fellowship, you know, at Harvard, and it sort of blew my mind. Here I was thinking, you know, I went back to work after a year long, and I just was sort of restless, and I got on a flight. And, you know, I'd set up an interview with the prosecutor. And so I went and just tried to just kind of poke around and see what I could figure out and see whether there was a real book in it, Dan. Yeah, that's pretty much how it happened. So it was like, you know, the thing that draws all folks to intrigue. It was, you know, gorgeous women. That's what it started.
Why not? Why not? Yeah. So before we go any further, just briefly explain what Redbone refers to in terms of black people. And so that whole phenomena, tell us a little bit about the light-skinned idea and what someone would be classified as Redbone. What is that description of that person?
I mean, you know, I mean, without going into a real deep history, I mean, we know what sort of happened in the, you know, in the big house or in the slave quarters during, you know, slavery. And so there was, you know, sure. race mixing. And so, you know, what you wound up with were, you know, these, you know, very fair skinned women with European features, you know, over time. And they tended also because they learned to read earlier than, you know, and they were kind of more pampered, you know, than sort of the, say, the house labor, you know. They were just fair-skinned, you know, and they had a level of status. And, of course, it was in the South. And so that word, really, you want to, like, really just divide a room of African-Americans, like, it, you know, it's sort of,
wow.
It can be offensive, you know, it's sort of like to call a girl red bone, but it is kind of a, it's Southern slang really for, black women, fair black women with like European features, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now the main subject of this book,
and
obviously,
and by the way, that's what Lance Herndon, the subject of the book, you know, that was his preference. That's what he liked, that kind of woman, you know. So that was hence the title.
Let's, before we talk about Lance Herndon, let's talk about Atlanta itself. And because you really do talk about, you know, a really forward-thinking mayor, a very progressive government in Atlanta that made it available that contracts were given to black people. So tell us a little bit about the fascinating history that you chronicle in this book about Atlanta and its rise to a place where they have five colleges and it's, you know, really, like you've mentioned, a mecca for black professionals and people, black people to aspire to a place where they could really achieve everything they really wanted to.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm working right now actually on a book on historically black colleges, a narrative. I mean, these colleges were born right after, you know, slavery to educate freed slaves. And they were birthed by, you know, white missionaries and abolitionists. And, you know, Atlanta became, you know, the kind of epicenter for, you know, sort of black higher education. And so today, you know, there's what Spellman and Clark. There's a struggling Morris Brown. There's Morehouse College, in which, you know, President Obama just a couple years ago gave the commencement. That's an all boys liberal arts school where, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King is among the graduates. You know, lots of graduates, whether it be a Spike Lee or Sam Jackson or Martin Luther King, you know, or Lewis Sullivan, the former Human Services cabinet head. And so it, you know, because of that, you've got generations of just really sort of educated black people, more than most cities in the country, arguably more than any, you know. And so, you know, the black elite in America have a tie, particularly, you know, a couple generations ago, like to Atlanta. And so you got kind of an old guard, you know, a blue blood class of doctors and lawyers, you know, like, I mean, when Dr. King graduated Morehouse, you know, in the 50s, I think he was third generation on his mother's side, you know, of Morehouse men.
Right.
And so this is how far back, you know, that kind of pedigree goes. And so that is the kind of old guard. It was the first, you know, one of the first cities, you know, to elect a black mayor, you know, and that was Maynard Jackson in the late 70s, you know, and Maynard Jackson used, you know, a lot of kind of set aside programs, you know, as Atlanta was growing up, and just sort of funneled business towards black entrepreneurs. And so, you know, to make sure that they were not left out of the city's growth. And so hence you got this class of the black millionaires. He created black, you know, a class of black wealth that was unparalleled, you know, and it was attractive. You know, when people heard that, it was kind of like a clarion call to folks in other parts of the country to come there,
right,
and try to break through themselves.
Now, the subject, as we mentioned, Lance Herndon, he's 41 at the time of his demise, so we'll go back. He was born in 1955, and he spent some time in Farmville, Virginia, because his family is, as you write, he had kind of had a family that really didn't, neglected him quite a bit, and his parents split when he was an adolescent, and he really looked up to and admired his grandparents, but especially his grandfather, John Harrison Herndon, and his grandmother, Elver. And so tell us a little bit about his early life, and before we talk about his 20s and when he becomes successful in his marriages. So tell us a little bit about his adolescence life, as you do in Redbone.
Yeah, I'm trying to, I mean, you are testing my memory here. The book was published in 07, and I'm now like a couple books in, but it's always fun to try to like reconnect to Lance, and I, you know, and I'm always fascinated by him. But I, you know, he was in the end a real, real, like, his work ethic was just really impressive, you know, and we'll get into that later in terms of how structured he was and how disciplined he was and how he knew how to make and stretch a dollar. But, you know, yeah, his mom, if I recall, you know, worked two or three jobs, you know, this is in New York. He was born. His dad was sort of he did like, I think some delivery stuff, but they were gone, you know, most of the time, and they raised him almost by like notes, you know, just leave a note on the fridge and this is what you eat. And so he wound up in Farmville, Virginia with his granddad, who was a farmer. And, you know, really that is where that work ethic started, right? He had a very, you know, he was a good student always, a really kind of technical mind, which led into, you know, the business that he wound up running, which we'll get into. But, yeah, Lance loved his granddad, right? I mean, that was his role model. And that's kind of where he got his ambition right there in Farmville, Virginia.
Now, let's skip a little bit ahead. You say he is a character. Now, one question after I ask this question here, in terms of, he has a couple failed marriages in his 20s, and then in the 90s, he meets his third wife while he's vacationing in Brazil, and she's staring at a statue of Jesus. And so it seems like it's, of course, divine intervention here, and he meets Jeanine Price. But before we go any further, describe Lance Herndon for us. He's about 5'10", but just his facial features and what he looks like.
You know, I mean, Lance was like, maybe not in like a classic sense, you know, like a real, you know, like a handsome guy, but he had like plenty of style. You know, he would, you know, had a regular appointment with the haberdasher in Atlanta, and he always had tailored clothes, and he was very sort of fastidious in his appearance, right? He was, you know, kind of small in stature, so maybe there was a bit of a Napoleon complex there. You know, he's a short cropped hair, and you know, not the best, kind of a ruddy skin, you know, but he was pulled together, man. He just pulled together and had a lot of, as the kids call it now, he had a lot of swag.
Yeah. What business does he eventually become a successful entrepreneur?
I mean, you know, sort of data processing and computers. So, you know, he would get the contract, like Atlanta, you know, the major companies, whether it was Nations Bank or Coca-Cola, you know, they would farm out some of their data processing. And so he would wind up getting pieces of that business, and he grew it. He grew it really large. For an entrepreneur, right?
And part of his success was that he was this super organized, super detailed person that would remember people's birthdays, send them presents, and do those little things to keep networks very, very strong. So he was very personable in that, very, very generous, but it was all business. But he was very, very serious about that type of business and that type of networking.
Yeah, I mean, he was the kind of guy, if he found out, you know, that you're son was a Braves fan, you know, he might just sort of like get a Braves hat, and like before you know, and he would ask what the kid's birthday was, and he would jot it down, and on that day he'd, you know, get you the, you know, the hat would show up at your office or your home or whatever. He was always really, really just super considerate, and he took, you know, he's really tedious with his notes about you, and it was kind of, it was opportunistic and shrewd, but it was also pretty flattering to people who were in his network. He never missed a birthday, you know. I mean, his calendar was like full from you know, when he died. It was like 3 years out. That's what a planner he was. It was also like, would get up, and I don't know whether, you know, he was an early riser. You know, he kept his business in his home, in his basement. So there was this, you know, sort of top two floors. And then beneath that, though, were the offices, because he was just like, okay, you know, it was an office suite. So his employees would enter and go down into that bottom level. But, you know, he would wake up at 3 a.m., right? And then he would go downstairs and he would record directions in like three or four tape recorders, like, you know, Zanya, I need you to call Nations Bank, and da 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 da, and Holly, I need you to make reservations for such and such. And he would leave there. So that way he didn't have to talk to him during the day. He thought talking to his employees was sort of inefficient. And so that's what he would do. I mean, that's the kind of, he had three, he was a heavy sleeper. So he had like three alarm clocks around the room. So one would go off. And then he might, you know, snooze a little, but the other one would go off, and they were set like at like 15, 20 minute intervals. I mean, he was just kind of like, you know, strange guy.
Now, he also, what was odd as well is that he was obsessive about, again, we talked about hygiene, but he would take 3 or 4 showers a day. But he would also, what you said, he would record instructions to his employees and have them on their desks, every single day. It was really reminiscent of the kind of notes that he got and the kind of parenting he got, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess that was it. I mean, he was sort of raised on sticky notes, and so I guess he took that. It worked, you know. And they expected that from him. You know, they expected to show up and have those directions recorded for them. That
now,
was their marching orders.
Now, let's talk about his lifestyle, and that including his love of women and his relationships with women and how he had those relationships and how they were characterized. So he was married. We'll talk about when he was married to Janine Price. Now, she's a beautiful woman, very, very attractive woman. How did he really look? He's a very serious businessman. How did he look at relationships, and how did he look at marriage?
I mean, to Lance, everything, I think, was, a stage, like really for show. And Janine was a trophy, she is from Kansas City, from a really sort of good solid middle class family. She moved to New York to be, to dance, and then she wound up as a corporate, like for a corporate flight attendant, so private planes for some of the large corporations based out of New York. And so when she happened to be in Rio, he was visiting, and that's where they met, and so I think that to him she was just kind of the perfect woman. But he was a serial, he was insatiable. He had plenty of women. I think he did, in fact, love Janine and what she represented, but it never stopped him from carousing. He was a known playboy around town. He was sort of like, he threw the best parties. He didn't mind spending money. He kept women on his, always, on the payroll, and gifted them. And that's what they, that was his reputation.
Now, you talk about having his office and his workers at his home, but let's describe this home, because we're, you talk about in some really exclusive areas in Atlanta where you have, the smallest home is 9,000 square feet plus. So just tell us about this lavish home slash business.
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to remember. It's in Roswell, which is, a suburb of Atlanta, and it's off of the Chattahoochee River, right? It sort of runs alongside of it. And it's very, very, it's a gated community. And I can't remember like the square footage of it, but it was, for that area, relatively palatial, and so, and it was adjoining, it sort of sat, right inside of a really kind of gorgeous wooded wooded lot. And so when you walk, you know, if you, it was three floors, and it was just, you know, but it was not, you know, he was a bachelor, so it didn't have a real kind of homey feel. It had almost a sterile feel. He had a housekeeper that would come in and clean it, you know, but it was just, you know, his lair, so to speak, you know?
And it was interesting too, for all those people that love cars, this guy had the kinds of cars that people, men especially, would be envious, but women are very, very interested in as well. So tell us the kind of cars other than Mercedes that he had.
I mean, I think like at times, I mean, he always kept like a Porsche. I think he had like a Lotus, you know, at one point, like an Alfa Romeo, you know, real just hot, cool cars. It was a nightclub guy. So I think during the day, he would drive maybe his Mercedes or his Volvo, but then when he would hit the clubs, he would take out the Lotus or something like that. And he was known always to just be in cool cars and always, you know, sort of treating everyone. I mean, he had, like I said, like a kind of a Gatsby-esque place, stature in this city, you know, the guy that they could depend on, you know, the lonely guy who was surrounded by people and partiers.
Now, before we get into some of the employees that he also had sometimes relationships with, let's talk about how successful he was in business and how long before that business sort of seemed to change, and yet his lifestyle didn't, and of course spending didn't.
Well, yeah, I can't, what I can say more broadly is that, you know, a lot of his success was rooted in, you know, a relationship with Bill Campbell, the mayor, and a lot of corporate folk. So he had government contracts and he had some corporate contracts. You know, but in order to really, really, I mean, Atlanta was being flooded with new talent all the time, just new people who wanted to kind of come in. And so he had competitors, you know, and I don't know whether or not he was really keeping up. I mean, when you deal in a technological industry, you got to stay fresh, you know, and he kind of started to take his eye off the ball because you know, Atlanta, and today it's really that. It started to become kind of an entertainment hub, you know. First R&B music, it was like Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Those guys were down there, and they produced, like, you know, Janet Jackson and, you know, a bunch of stuff. Then there were these other producers, and then it became kind of, today it's very kind of a hip hop hub, and also television. You know, I think Black Entertainment Television, BET, has its own, like, I think a studio now. Tyler Perry, the director, is there, and so he kind of, that was where the, like, the action was, and he started sort of wanting to manage acts and things like that to sort of continue to be relevant in the kind of way that the with the new guard, the up and comers, the new sort of strivers. And so I think, you know, he was spending more money in the end than he was making.
The other thing you talk about is, and it really talks about his character, especially when it seems to be, you know, he's losing his place, you know, so he's a little bit desperate and he wants to get into this younger, but also he's got his interest in music. So he sort of latches on, gets an opportunity with a guy that says, listen, I need $7,000. I got a little bit of a cash flow problem. And not knowing the kind of character that Lance is, Lance hones in on this, using it as his opportunity to get in on management. And you talk about some of the embarrassing things that go on. So tell us a little bit, just in general, about how he kind of overextends himself, we'll say.
You may be referring to, you know, there was one group called Arrested Development, back in the day, and I think they had won a Grammy, and they produced, you know, one female star kind of rolled out of that, Dion Faris.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Lance, you know, he jumped into the mix and wanted to kind of manage her. And without any real, I mean, he was a fish out of water, but you couldn't tell him that because he was cocky and he knew business. And, you know, he would show up at the studio and kind of try to guide her. And, you know, and he just thought that she was a little too, you know, didn't have it right. I think at one point he'd gone into the studio and she had like a snake around her neck, and, you know, and he was just like, what the hell is this? Like, are we doing music? He's, you know, accused her of wasting his money and this, that, and the other. And they were just like, you know, get this guy out of here. I think it was a wreck, you know. But meanwhile, he was also doing other cool things. Like, he had a, this connect with the, I think it was with the Navy. And so he put together once which, you know, it's kind of made history. Now, everybody remembers this, where, you know, he had like a luncheon and took some of his favorite clients out on like a submarine, you know, because he had a connect. Somebody owed him a favor, so he got him like a submarine ride, you know, off the coast of, I think, Florida. So that's the kind of stuff he would do, which was like, I mean, someone takes you on a submarine, like, you might love them forever. That's the kind of stuff he did.
Now, let's talk about some of the people that vowed to love him forever and included some of those, again, lovers and employees slash employees and mistresses. So, and we've got to sort this all out for our audience, definitely. So let's talk about first Zonya Adams and what was her role with the company. And what was her relationship with him? Did she have a personal, intimate relationship with him?
Yeah, well, Zonya was his solid right hand, you know, married. She was actually married to a guy who was a head of a singing group, Silk, you know.
Right.
I think it was Silk.
Yep.
Which was a big, you know, at the time, kind of a hot group. But she was sort of the office manager and like always had Zonya's back. It was like she was so not interested in him, you know, romantically, you know. She sort of kept him at bay in that way, but she was just valuable because she was solid and ran like a tight ship. Zonya Adams, yep.
Now another... manager. So she was the solid person that really wasn't tangled up in him with relationship wise. Now, who was Lacey Banks, and what did she do for him, and what was she to him personally?
I mean, that was like a complicated relationship. Lacey was from a small town in North Carolina, had moved to Atlanta, and I think maybe had done some temp work under him at one point, but really was a sweet girl who was also really, you know, ambitious and attractive, right? So he kind of like mentored her to some degree, but also started to sleep with her, right? And then she almost just became like a off and on companion. So she would toggle between being a lover and a worker, and then sometimes, you know, it was almost like an understanding, you know, that she would do sexual favors for him, or maybe even to be, you know, I mean, now and then, maybe even an important client that he might ask her to go out with. Yeah.
So that's the other part of it too. He did. You just alluded to it a little bit, but let's get to it. She would participate in threesomes with other guys and with other women, and that was just part of the lifestyle.
It was part of the deal, you know, and I mean, he would slip money into her bank account, and so she was just available to him. But they also, like, he talked to her, and she talked to him, and that, you know, she was a little younger than him, And, I spent a lot of time out there. She now is like a soccer mom, out in like Denver. Her life has changed. But at the time, she really had a lot of love for him. She said that she was, he was not even really, it was easy work for her because he wasn't really even a great lover. He just liked sex, but he wasn't great at it, But she liked him. She liked him.
Now tell us a little bit about Kathy Collins and what she meant to him.
Yeah, I mean, like Kathy was, high fashion, high maintenance, gorgeous, eye candy, who, whenever he was out at something important, you'd see him with Kathy because she, was well spoken and ambitious and the right person to have on his arm and always kind of seeing the opportunity and seizing it and bringing it to him. And so I think they kind of shared that kind of ambition. And she understood that and she liked that about him, that he was sort of a boss, kingpin.
Now,
And
tell
that
us
was his main lady. She had clothes
okay.
hanging in his closet. That was,
Yeah.
yeah.
That's pretty serious. Now, tell us a little bit about Holly and any other employee that was important to this story as you read it.
Well, Holly was the an employee, and I think she was just a good old solid worker. She was the only white person at the company. She was, what I do remember, I mean, had one thing that stood out was, she had gorgeous, gorgeous handwriting. Like she did calligraphy. So when it was time to really be impressive and send like that note to someone, like the Christmas cards and stuff like that, thank you letters. He could turn to Holly and she would just put something gorgeous together to send out.
Now, you talked about
That was it. Those were the employees. It was sort of Holly, like typically, unless it was like a big kind of and they are the ones that came into the home every day, Zanya,
now you talk
Holly.
about
Yeah.
Lacey's boyfriend, this Jimmy Sweet Turner. So again, you talked about the complication of this. Lacey was in a relationship with him. It was more intimate, more frequent at different times over those 12-year period of time. So she has this Jimmy Sweet Turner, which becomes important in this story. So this guy seems to be constantly in debt, but and very important to this. So tell us a little bit about Sweet Turner and how's his relationship with Lacey? And then tell us about how there ended up being a loan from Lance Herndon to Turner.
I mean, you may, yeah, again, you're challenging me here, Dan. But so, I mean, so there's Lance who was out of her league, but she loved to hang with, right? And then she
Sure.
had regular guys that, were her contemporaries that she would go out with, and her boy, and they were not Lance, they were typically wannabes. And one guy was this, Jimmy, and that was her boyfriend. And at one point, Lance loaned him money because, of course, he was doing, he was doing, her a favor, right? And so he didn't get paid back, so he went and just took the guy's car and had the car. I think that's the that was that that was that was it.
Yeah, it
And he
seemed
did that
to.
all the time to people. That's what he would do, And that was, that was sort of one of his business moves, to be honest. Like when he saw something he wanted, he would sort of make a loan knowing that you couldn't sort of pay it back, you know, and that is how he would insert himself into your life.
Now, we do get
sounds
to
like a bad guy,
his birthday party.
It sounds like, he doesn't sound like a really nice guy, does it? But, you know, it wasn't really viewed as that. Like, you know, I mean, he was shrewd, but, you know, in doing the reporting on that, you know, he came across as fairly non-threatening. Like I said, he was a pretty small guy, you know. Nobody was really afraid of him, but he was pretty shrewd.
Now, he has this birthday party, and in true lavish style, again, we're going to jump ahead a little bit to realize that his business is not doing so well. His, like I mentioned, his lifestyle, he kept spending the same amount of money. He had people like Dion Bao. Maybe you can talk about her. She had only come into the fold about 3 months earlier. But what was her attraction? What did he see in her? Didn't he have enough women and enough complication in his life? What brought her to him?
Right. Well, you know, he had, like I said, connects all over town, and so he was having this birthday bash. He was turning 40, and he was having it at the top of the, you know,
Hilton,
I believe, right? You know, which overlooked, like, you know, Stone Mountain, and it was just a beautiful view. And so, you know, he invited the city's movers and shakers to celebrate with him. And so he invited one of the sort of top managers at MARTA, which is their public transportation company, you know, runs the sort of subway system and, you know, buses and stuff like that. He invited an executive of MARTA, but that executive's assistant saw that invite and thought, like, wow, okay, and got herself invited because, you know, Lance's reputation preceded him. And so, yeah, she shows up at his 40th. Dion Ball.
Yeah, Dion
uninvited. But he uninvited. Wasn't mad at her because she was, you know, when he met her, she fit in. She was fair skin and in his eyes, you know, a looker.
The other thing was, is that the other, to just talk about this birthday party, it invited a couple hundred people, so it was a big affair, and Lacey Banks was there, but knew her place, and so she stood by the side.
That's right. I mean, he could depend on her. But, you know, what's funny, though, is, like, they had actually, he had a room in the, I learned this in the reporting, he had a room in the Hilton, you know, and so prior to the party, you know, they had already kind of had their little thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And who was he with that night officially?
Kathy. His main lady, yes.
And what was the birthday party like? Was there any problems? Was there any interruptions? Any incidents?
No, it was a big, big festive thing, you know, with chocolates and all sorts of, you know, golf shrimp and appetizers and great music. You know, that guy, the R&B star, Zanya's husband, came and sang happy birthday. And, you know, and he loved, yeah. Lance loved to dance. And so that was a great party. It was a great party. And that's where he met Dion and danced with her. And that's where their courtship started.
Now, when did this party end? And what did Kathy notice this, you know, sudden relationship or notice the meeting between the two?
I'm not sure she noticed it at that party, but certainly, you know, she could start to feel the distance post-party because he started dating Dion, you know, on the side. He sort of had two women going. He really was smitten with Dion, you know, because she was from Jamaica. She had the accent and she was bright, and she was fashionable, and she was highly sexualized. And so they started an affair.
And what was he providing for her? You talk about a Mercedes was given to her and a credit card in case she needed something. So
yeah,
it was a serious
3-4 months in. Yeah, that's what he did. Like he was giving her money, which was sort of like his modus operandi, really. And then but the big one was she was having some car issues. She was a student at Georgia. I want to say Georgia State. It's right in Atlanta. He leased a Mercedes in her name, in his name, and let her, tool around in it. That was her vehicle.
And he was supporting her
through
school.
Little did he know. And I don't want to jump too far, but little did he know was that she was, married.
And she was married. She had children as well?
She had a daughter, right. So she was a naturalized immigrant from Jamaica, and her husband was back home with their daughter. She had met him in, Miami, and so they were having but he was a pilot, not like for a very small airline like Jamaica Air or something, but he would move back and forth, come back and forth and see her, but generally she was there alone, right? He was raising the daughter, so she kind of had set up this life in Atlanta and was dating this, baller.
And what was Kathy's, how long did it take for Kathy to sort of get a whiff of what was going on?
I think pretty early on. I mean, there was one incident in which he had, Dion proved to have quite the temper, and I think that this is when he said, like, okay, I'm in hot water here. He was with Kathy one night. And Dion, he was in his home, and Kathy, they were in bed. Kathy just had, a robe on, and, Dion came by unannounced. I think she used to go over there and study sometimes and just sit and hang around. And, she knocked on the door, and, Lance didn't answer the door. And she knocked and knocked and knocked, and she knew he was in there. And then she just started to really go off and, act pretty crazy out there. And so he called the cops, and played it off. Like, there's someone I don't know outside, which was ridiculous. But that was what he did in order to protect himself with Kathy. Like, I don't even know. There's a crazy woman outside. And so, when the police showed, she was combative, and they ended up picking her up, and he let them pick her up. He never really came outside, which was really cowardly, but that's what he did. And the next day, he sort of called and figured out some way to smooth it over. But he realized then, whoa, this woman's got a temper.
So what was his next move after that, once he realized that he had a problem, a big problem?
I think he started to try a little bit to distance himself. But, they were connected sexually. So he was sort of torn. And he never really broke it off. Even though, the people who really had his back, like Zanya, could say, okay, this is bad. This is bad. Like, she's calling the office. She acts like she, runs this play. Like, she could tell this is not going to be good.
And so what is...
It was late. It was too late.
Okay, so talk about day in question. Talk about how anybody discovers. Talk about the day of the incident and previous. What does Lance do and who does he meet? He talks to Lacey Banks that day, but what, according to reports, what seems to be what occurred involving Lacey?
Well, so if you recall, like, you know, that year, which would have been like 96.
Yes.
That was, you know, the world, that was, Atlanta was the stage for the Olympics.
Right.
And so, you know, the city had sort of transformed itself to be ready for the Olympics, and it hosted the games successfully. And, you know, on Sunday, I think, which is sort of customary, they do kind of a special Olympics thing, and it's sort of winding down. But on that Monday morning, and Lance really partied hard during that Olympics. I mean, obviously, the city was just, you know, just a playground, right? Big social, you know, hub. And so Lance, they, that morning, as I mentioned, he would always leave that tape out there. He'd been leaving it for his employees for years. On this day, they go downstairs, to their station, their workstation, and there is no tape. And they're like, okay, this is odd. This is really odd. You know, and the next employee comes in and they talk about how odd it is. So it's like Zanya and then Holly. And then the mother, they call because they don't have entree to the rest of the house, but they panic. The mom actually has, by then, had moved to Atlanta, lived not far, could come over, you know, and check on her son. So they call Miss Herndon and say, look, there are no tapes. We haven't heard from Lance. This is odd. Do you know where he is? And she said, well, Lance, you know, he probably is still asleep. He hung out really hard. I don't know. I'll be over there in a minute. So they come by. She comes by the house. You know, sees that the garage door is sort of partly open, checks some things out, then goes up, doesn't see him downstairs, doesn't see anything, goes up to the bedroom, and then they hear her, this blood-curdling scream. And they don't know what the heck that is. They just hear her screaming and running, and they just, the rumble of the floor above them. They go into the closet and hide. They think that something like there's a robbery going on. They don't know. But it's her sort of panic because she finds her son bludgeoned to death. You know, he's laying there. He's naked. The way when the detectives show, so she calls 911, and when they show, you know, they find, this is what they find. They find like a really strong sexual element to this crime scene. They find, you know, in the VCR, they find like a porn tape. It's not on, but it's in there. And there's another one sitting out. They find him naked. They find condoms up on the shelf, on the sort of bureau. They see some footsteps. There's no forced entry. They don't find any forced entry into the home, but they just find like a honeycomb sort of imprint on the carpet. They see blood spatter on the walls. And they don't see any real defensive wounds though. And they find in the commode, they find bloody pillowcase. Yep. And so, you know, they sort of figure, based on what they see, you know, that it was a crime of passion. I guess they kind of decide that because, number one, the guy's face was like covered up, and I think that they couldn't like stand the look at what they had done. They also find, what else did they, what else did they, and
Yeah, the
no, and
alarm
no, and,
clocks.
yeah, the alarm clocks were unplugged. So whoever
Three of
did
them,
that,
yeah.
they figured like, yeah, the three, they figured, okay, this person, they must have known those clocks were gonna go off, right? So yeah, maybe you know, I think I'm covering, pretty much covering all of that, right?
Well, basically, what they did, like you said, is that this ends up being really circumstantial because there is no weapon. They find no
No
murder
weapon.
weapon.
No.
They find pubic hairs, but they would expect to find a lot of people's hairs at that time based on his promiscuity. So that didn't help them. They had found no physical evidence. They say there was no forced entry, no robbery. So they were
Right.
starting at, well, square one, and hence why it took so long with this case as well.
That's right. That's right.
What is the media response and how do they portray this story in the newspapers and television?
Well, I mean, you know, Lance was sort of a kind of a high profile figure. So, you know, that was the way they found him was just really kind of shocking, embarrassing to him. You know, he was a huge, huge fundraiser for various politicians, and so they wanted to distance themselves from him. You know, it was also a shock by you know, where it occurred, which was this really, you know, very quiet enclave in Roswell. And yeah, it was a shocker.
Now, who is the? We can't go through how the. I mean, you, as you describe in the book, it takes quite a bit of time. So they go through all the suspects very, very meticulously and carefully, and have to come back to some people. But who is their prime suspect, and what did the police do initially, and immediately after this murder, in terms of trying to suss out who their suspect might be?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were three, so it was like, okay, prior there was Talana, no, not Talana, there was Lacey, I'm sorry, one of his women, and Lacey, you know, okay, she'd seen him last because he had this event that he was planning for, and so she had come by the house and was helping him put together some invitations, and so they tried her. Obviously, they thought of like, okay, Janine, they had been divorced. Or they were separated, and so, you know, the ex-wife, that one always comes up, you know, and then there was Kathy, who could have been, you know, he was cheating on her, so she was kind of a suspect, but they ruled all of those folks kind of had alibis, right? And then there was Dion, the Jamaican, you know, she's married, but he'd like given her, like, you know, he was kind of her sugar daddy. You know, and there was one key, you know, and his whole kind of fastidiousness. She used to borrow his computer. That was, you know, like for school, and you know, he'd loan it to her, but it always had a case on it. I mean, he was never gonna let that computer out with the case, without the case. And so when they went to talk to her, you know, they searched her home, and that computer was there because they said, look, and when they, you know, one of the things the employees said, like, look, like all we know is that the one thing that's missing in here is that computer, and Dion always borrowed the computer, and the case is here, but the computer's gone. They found that computer at her home, so really started to try to figure out, like, narrow the timeline on when that case left the house
The other thing is
and wound
interesting
up
is
in our home. Yes.
you introduce this detective Anastasio, And this guy says, I'm going to go back and start doing some interviews. So there are many interviews, but he gets to a chance to talk to Sean Nelson, which is Dion's husband. And so they have, yeah. And what he finds out after the fact is that there's information like, unbeknownst to him, is that Dion was having this affair, but unbeknownst to him as well is that he had the Mercedes. She had told him that some other fanciful story about where she got the Mercedes just from some, you know, a friend who's supportive of her education. So there wasn't gradually his, especially when they had a phone call where Lance had called and demanded to talk to her, and her husband Sean wanted to know why he wanted to talk to her. And so you tell us a little bit more about the story, because it really demonstrates quite a bit about a couple of these characters, in fact all of them.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I guess one time, like Sean, as I mentioned, would come in and, you know, and to see his wife. And during, you know, and as he was coming in, he was noticing she was more and more distant toward him, but also, you know, was getting this material, like was sort of these gifts. He was not, and at one point she picked him up from the airport, and she had a Mercedes, and you know, and she explained that, okay, you know, I've got this mentor guy and he let me, you know, drive it or whatever, and it just didn't add up. So one day, you know, I guess they're in bed together and Lance calls the Dion's house and Sean answers the phone and is like, who is this? You know, and they kind of have a little confrontation. And, you know, and I think Lance kind of threatens Sean. So, yeah, there was a lot of tension around that. But one thing that's key, Dan, is that during that one incident, this is really, really important to the sort of murder and motive and what have you, is there are a couple things we've gone over, you know. One, how fastidious he was and what a planner he was. And that night, you know, he logged everything into his computer, into his calendar. And that calendar was managed by his employees. And that when Dion came to his house unannounced, there was a court date and he told her that he was going to show up and sort of get her off on that. He was going to testify or whatever at this court date and get this whole thing, you know, matter taken care of, expunged or whatever. And
right.
So on this particular, like on the night of this murder, you know, she had gone to the home, right? And this is what, you know, sort of the picture that gets painted anyway, is that this was the night before he was supposed to show up at court. And I think, like, so they made love, he falls asleep, she goes downstairs while he's asleep and checks his calendar and sees that there is absolutely, it's that his appearance, his schedule, it's not on there. And this is where the, you know, the sort of picture gets painted, is that she goes back upstairs. He had been putting together, supposedly, you know, because they couldn't find a murder weapon. He had apparently had been putting together kind of like a Stairmaster of some sort. And there was a crescent wrench that was there, like at seen apparently by the valet of that house and the housekeeper and all of that, that crescent. So apparently she, you know, straddled him while he was asleep and brought that wrench down on him some 14, 15 times. And you could sort of look at the spatter on the wall and you could see, you know, and there were a couple times where he may have tried to move and, you know, it came down on the crown of his head. But that's the way this whole thing, that's the way the prosecutor painted the night. And that was the kind of motive, was that she realized that he was just playing her and she was just enraged.
The other part of her was quite irrational, and she also had was had that the big lie with her husband in the phone call the night before the murder, where she had bought a house for 180,000. She had the Mercedes, and so then there was a little bit of more evidence to this was that she ordered some antique piece of furniture the day
After he was
after with the credit
dead,
card.
like, yeah, like ran up the credit cards, like after his, you know, death. Yeah.
And she had said to her husband Sean, I mean, again, you categorize him as wimpy, and he definitely is. He said, you got to give that car back. And have you ever slept with this guy? And she said, of course not. No, I never slept with him. But he gave me a Mercedes to use. But she said, well, I'll give it to him back to him gradually. I don't want to get him mad or anything. And so he agreed
Right.
with that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, he was from, you know, really sort of well-to-do family. I mean, by all accounts, he was just like a really good, supportive, sweet guy who was way over his head with this very cunning woman that he married.
Now, as very much to be expected, she gets a really good attorney eventually, and then he realizes he's a little over his head in terms of experience, so he gets another experienced guy, and they make a pretty good team and sort of a soft, like you call it, a soft touch in the cross-examination. And the other guy, he's really Quinn. He's really aggressive, and so he can do some damage and make some headway in terms of on the stand with these witnesses, and you have everybody from Lacey Banks, who's 8 months pregnant, taking the stand, to Kathy Collins taking the stand, and in the end, Dion Bau takes the stand as well. Very, very interesting. Tell us a little bit about the testimony of Dion on the stand, the cross-examination.
No,
Well, in terms of just
Dion. No,
eliciting
they
the
never put her
victim.
on the stand. They never put Dion Ball on the stand.
Okay, sorry.
No. Dion Ball. That would have been a nightmare. I mean, the Kathy. You know the Kathy. Like, you know, they put Kathy was sort of the star of that in a kind of a humorous way, because Kathy, you know, got on this, like, what, you know, she was just such a diva. You know, one of the things that she was worried about, like, was, like, during the crime, like, as the investigators had sort of shut the house down, you know, she had clothes in there, and, like, she was pissed off because they wouldn't let her kind of come in there and get her wardrobe. And so she put, like, a 2 or 3 page list of all this designer stuff that she needed to get out of that house, you know. So that was that
Yeah.
kind of, you know, yeah. I mean, he had sort of some real characters around him, you
Yeah, it was
know.
interesting. She specified Merlot wine had to be, that was hers, she said. It was
Yeah, that was it. Yeah,
specifically he bought that
exactly.
for her.
Right. That was how, yeah, that's what she wanted to. Yeah, this man's dead. And, you know, but I think, like, Lacey was genuinely hurt. Like, her friend, yeah, that was her friend.
Now you talk about the thing as well, and it in terms of by the time this trial starts, it looks like his friends are gone, and Dion Bau doesn't have her many supporters whatsoever. So it's just the media there, but everybody takes their turn testifying.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of, you know, this kind of reflects the superficiality of his life. You know, I mean, he had worked so hard to develop these networks of people and had been successful at that. But, you know, the more he was just dragged through the mud, and the more just was, you know, you learned about him, the more people wanted to distance themselves from him. So he was very much alone, you know, and you know, and ultimately I just wanted in the book to, I asked myself sort of, you know, this big question, you know, like, you know, you hear about black males dying all the time on like street corners, you know, and this was a guy who was anything but that, yet he died, you know, and in a really violent way. And so it was like, what, how does a man kind of with the world at his fingertips, you know, wind up dying that kind of horrific death? You know, what, and how much of a role did, you know, sort of the values of sort of the black nouveau riche in Atlanta play into that, and the sort of skewed value systems, and you know, and I wanted to, and I, all that's the question I wanted to ask, you know, like if you know, there's these theories, you know, of like this whole kind of black male as a kind of endangered species, and, you know, being, you know, selected out, you know, in some way, you know, to what extent, you know, what role do they play in their own kind of demise? And that was sort of the broader question. And so Lance, in my, you know, was sort of a cautionary tale, a kind of metaphor for, you know, you know, success kind of gone awry, if you will. Yeah. So that's what I was trying to get at with that, Dan.
I think too that he had great success. You know, you don't portray him as really a bad guy. He wasn't a bad guy. He was a serious business guy. He seemed to be a nice guy, really. He seemed to be a pretty good guy. Despite being a successful businessman, and he could manipulate, take advantage of people, he seemed to be a pretty good guy. But with that being said, he had a good relationship with Lacey Banks. He had a solid relationship with Zonya Adams. These people were really friends of his, and he could trust these people. And so he had Kathy Collins, and before that, Jeanine Price. And he had close friends, like, as you talk about in the book, Paul Howard from that was very influential in this case as well. People that knew him.
DA, and the DA himself, right. The DA himself knew him. He was friends with him, you know? And so the DA was kind of a quest. Like, I got to help. Like, I got to figure this out. And, you know, I mean, it sort of happened even for me. Cause as I mentioned, I had gone down there, Dan, like just poking around, and I was like, okay, who's this big player, you know, and this is really, really kind of like a Dominique Dunn kind of yarn. And I was just viewing it from the prism of just a really interesting whodunit, you know, and I did two or three trips. And then there was like one trip I went, and I don't remember, I was sitting, it was late night, and, you know, we were tired. I was in the assistant prosecutor, Clint Rucker's office. And he sort of said, hey, man, have you ever seen the crime scene pictures? And I said, no. Mm-mm. In fact, I haven't. He said, hold on. And he left, and he came back a couple minutes later, and it was an envelope, and he, like, tossed them out, you know, took the pictures out and tossed them on the table right there in front of me on the desk. And when I saw these photographs, I had never seen that. Like, this was someone whose just skull was just bashed in dozens of times. And I really felt like a little embarrassed that I hadn't truly considered the humanity of this person, you know, that no one, based on what I had been hearing, like, he didn't need to die like that. He didn't need to die at all, but goodness gracious, what a death. And I thought, like, you know, the least I could do in the book, if I can somewhat kind of humanize him, and you know, give him back some of that dignity, then that's, you know, and that's also was what I was trying to pull off.
Well, you know, you really do have access to information that, that, you know, really Dion Bao is really a psychopath, and her treatment of her husband and her own child, and of course this person that was her benefactor at this time, to turn on him like this. And like, again, we can't go through the whole trial at all, but there was a question that could a 5'3" woman, 110 pounds, do this much damage no matter how mad she was?
Right, right. Well, you know, if the guy was asleep, you know, and couldn't react, and there were no real defensive wounds on his sort of, you know, on his forearms or any of that, you know, I mean, that was the scenario that was painted. Is that, you know,
now,
she just sort of, yeah.
Throughout this trial, of course, his defense lawyers rightfully are trying to cast doubt on people like, or cast suspicion, pardon me, on people like Lacey Banks or Kathy Collins or anyone else they can through their successive cross-examinations of these witnesses. What is the Dion Bao's demeanor at trial?
I mean, she's sort of like really, really stoic. Like, there's not that much emotion whatsoever. You know, she almost smug, you know, which is typically her disposition, frankly, you know. And I mean, when I went into the prison and met her, I found her to be kind of like that too. And maybe I misread her, but even in prison, you know, there was nothing humble about her.
Mm-hmm.
And she went to trial a couple of times. I mean, at one point I had been trying to get in to see her. I figured, like, there's no way I can get to this. I can finish this doggone book without, like, talking to her. I got to talk to her. She's in prison now, you know. And I would send these letters to her. They would always come back rejected, rejected, rejected. And some folks in the newsroom said, look, man, you need to send her, like, you need to become a little human. Like, send her a picture. Let her know who you are. And I sent her a picture of myself and talked a little bit. And I came back rejected again, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I finally met her, I had gone into Atlanta. I went in and I had a suit on and stuff. I'll tell you how I got, you know, to meet her. But anyway, when I got in there, I said, like, wow, I'm surprised you know, agreed to meet with me. And she's like, well, yes, you look more important today. You have a suit on. With the picture you sent me had like a leather jacket on. I only deal with like important people. Something really ridiculous like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't have any cufflinks either.
I didn't, and I was trying, you know, I just went the wrong angle, I guess, you know, but.
So she is continually just denied this, right? No matter what, in the face of evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But despite everything, obviously she was convicted. And what was the sentence in that state? What can they give her? Can they give her life without parole?
No. Actually, I went through so many permutations. So, like, he was, the first trial was over, the decision was overturned because they said that Anastasio, the detective, was sort of leading the witness, right? And then the second trial was a hung jury. And then the Sam House, before the third trial, Sam House was the chief investigator and a really key, you know, witness, died. And so they didn't think after the hung jury they didn't think that they could necessarily, and people had moved on, they didn't know whether they could get a conviction again. And so she pled guilty, and she got, I think, that she's free now. Dion Ball is like, yeah, she's not behind bars now.
So it was down to a manslaughter.
Right. Yeah. I think she got like 7 or 8 years, and she had already like done three.
She had been offered a deal that might have given her even less time than that, but she was not interested in it. And apparently, and you write in your book, once she was in prison, she was freaking out. She says, where's my bottled water?
Yeah, where's my bottled water? Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not a country club. It's a prison.
And so what was your overall impression from this woman? You know, I mean, I guess I don't know how many words you can describe. Was she desperate? Was she cocky? What was your overall impression after your interview with him or with her?
No, I really think, like you said, that she was a sociopath. I think that the idea, I mean, Lance Herndon was kind of a master manipulator. And, you know, I think she took him very seriously and at his word. And I think I think he just encountered the wrong person. And I think she snapped on him.
What do you think her motive was, that he made, that the sugar daddy was not going to be there anymore, and that was the
right
reason, plus the court case itself? So
yeah, that he lied to her, that he was not planning on coming and looking out for her. She was afraid of what would happen to her on that end, and I think she was just like, how dare you, you know? And, you know, he had sex with her moments before.
Mm-hmm. yeah. One of the interesting thing was the one of the bigger mistakes she made was to use that credit card that next day to buy something.
Yeah, that was not smart.
And you also have a very, very interesting, when they originally when Anastasio went to her home and she pretended not to be home, then ran out to the neighbor after the police had already canvassed the neighborhood. And then the neighbor ratted on her and said, yeah, she was just asking me what you had asked her or what she had asked us about you. And so then they returned. And then there was this whole incredible theatrical scene where she was running and falling down and crying, but, you know, no tears, though.
With no tears, right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. She's just among some of the wild characters in this story, Redbone, including Lance, too. I mean, you talk about a guy that you say is particular, but this guy was really a very, very interesting guy and wanting this certain lifestyle. And so it is a fascinating tale, and you bring the reader right into this incredible world of opulence and,
that.
I guess, I don't know about decadence, but at least it was definitely... some lavish stuff going on here, some money being spent, and so some people doing well. So very, very interesting. So I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Redbone, the millionaire.
Thank you, Dan, very much.
Now, if people want to know a little bit more, I don't know if you have a website or if you do Facebook, so tell us if there is any way
website,
for people who might want to
contact. I mean, there's, you know, it's my name, you know, Ron Stodgill. Ron Stodgill, STODGHILL.com. You know, and you'll see the book on that. There, you know, HarperCollins was the publisher of that book, so it's still available, you know, on Amazon. You can get it there, and, you know, the Barnes, all those sites, you know. And so, and then it's been every, if you watch enough TV, you know, I've been on, it's been on like a couple of the true crime things because people would find different angles. Like, you know, people like the Lance Herndon thing, you know. I mean, but I gotta say that this is your take and your examination has been like the most thorough that I've ever done.
Oh,
so you've read it,
well,
and
thanks.
I'm flattered, Dan. And you do an excellent job at this. So I appreciate it, and you challenged me. You know, bravo.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. No, it was my pleasure. I mean, it's just a fantastic book and an incredible read. And again, it's just a fascinating slice of history for everybody that, you know, at that time, anybody that lived anywhere, you get the slice of Americana that you just, everything included, the R&B music, the guy singing happy birthday to Lance, and then shortly after, his face is crushed in his own bed by somebody he gave a Mercedes to and gave her $180,000. So, wow.
Yeah.
So much for treating anybody good anyway. So, yeah. Yeah.
That's an understatement. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Yes. Okay.
Well, thank you. Have a great night.
Good evening. Oh, you too. Bye-bye.
Good night. Good night.